only its importance, but its complexity. I shall have to differ a little bit with my distinguished fellow American, Russell Kirk, in his implication that the issue, so far as democracy is concerned, is between what he calls territorial democracy and the totalitarian centralized democracy that is creeping over the entire world. Coming from perhaps the worst governed state in the United States, in spite of the fact that Mr. Kirk is a justice of the peace there, it is courageous of him to suggest that territorial democracy will solve our problems, but I think it is also rash. Now, I am all for territorial democracy, for limited democracy, and there is no doubt that, as Aristotle pointed out originally, and as James Madison confirmed in Time and Again in the Federalist Papers, that democracy, in the sense of political democracy, does work in a small, confined area, but does not work over a large area. One can say for the federal system in the United States, and one should say, that in the states itself, where you get a dictatorship, as we had in Louisiana under Huey Long, and as we were approaching in Michigan under Menon Williams with Walter Ruther behind the scenes, one can say that that's relatively harmless because it won't spread beyond the confines of Michigan. But the point is that some of the essential trouble in difficulties affecting democracy affected in a localized as well as in an overall composition. And that should lead us to think a little. Now, I want to suggest a point that has not yet come up yet here, but which follows naturally on what Professor Loveday said, that this word democracy, which in the time of Sir Henry Maine on political thinkers have criticized for its impeding basis, is used by us generally to cover two quite different forms of thinking. One is the social aspect of democracy, and the other is the political aspect of democracy, in the sense of giving to the majority, even the bare majority, the determining force. That, of course, is just a technique of government. There is no principle behind that, no discernible principle of any kind. Whereas, of course, behind social democracy, there is a very discernible principle. Whether biologically true or not, there is the principle that all men should be equal before the law, that a man's a man for all that, as Professor Loveday's national poet said long ago, also Russell Kirk's national poet, and that in the sight of God, all men, being his children, are brothers. Now, I believe it is fair to say that social democracy had its inception with Christianity, that it was never a force until the coming of Christ, until the lesson of Christ. And Christ obviously did not mean his kingdom was not of this world. He did not intend this type of democracy, so far as we can tell, to be applied politically. But an inevitable result of the spread of the feeling of the essential equality of mankind was its politicization, you may say, the political application of that. And we now stand in the paradoxical situation where a vision of mankind which is elevating and forward-looking and inspiring in every respect from a social viewpoint has been perverted and diverted to a political system which has been shown time and again can only lead in the long run to tyranny. And I think we have got to dichotomize to divide our conception of democracy, and as Professor Loveday was doing, and speak of it as two quite different things before we can learn to get the necessary fusion in regard to the worldly game. But what we see today, what we confront today politically, is an ominous emphasis on political democracy, an ominous emphasis on the volonté générale of Rousseau, which, if carried out everywhere, can only lead towards centralization and eventually to dictation. It implies collectivity. Democracy implies collectivity. And by implying collectivity, I say democracy in the sense that it is used on the hustings today, it becomes incompatible with the idea of individual freedom. There is no reason why representative government should be equated with democracy. Many of you are doubtless familiar with Mill's famous John Stuart with the thought of protecting the individual, the freedom of the individual, originally, of course, against the state. Thus, we have the principle of the independence of the judiciary. I could not help thinking this morning when Otto von Habsburg was emphasizing the importance of the judiciary, of the law in the picture, and I think he's absolutely right in suggesting that we emphasize that a little too much, the legislative and executive components of government, not the importance of the judiciary, but that if you don't have an independent judiciary, if you've lost the conception of the reasons for an independent judiciary, a judiciary independent of the executive, why then you have no reliance on the judiciary at all. The judiciary in communist countries today, in Soviet-occupied Germany, is a pretty small safeguard for the rights of the people. Now we're losing that sense of those basic liberal principles everywhere. We're losing them in the United States. If I may be allowed to reminisce for just a moment, when President Roosevelt was very much blocked in the early days of the New Deal by the adverse decisions of the Supreme Court, you will remember that he produced a plan for enlarging the Supreme Court by several members. It was called by the adversaries of that name his court-packing plan, which is a little editorial word, but it was a scheme to enlarge the court. Well, I was at that time the editor of the Washington Post, and we ran a series of editorials day after day during that long fight, all geared to that simple principle of the importance of the independence of the judiciary, which Mr. Roosevelt's plan obviously threatened, because the idea was transparent. The court as constituted was overruling him on constitutional grounds. Therefore, to add three, four members of his own appointment to the court of his own appointment would swing the balance. The purpose was perfectly transparent. We got hundreds of letters in response to our editorial. The editorial. And what impressed me was the number of those letters. Some were favorable, more were adverse. But the number of letters from obviously intelligent people who could at least write grammatical English, who could have passed Mill's test for a representative government on that score anyway, who did not for a moment see what we were talking about. The tenor of those letters was universally, you mean to say that you don't trust our great president? The idea that a principle was at stake here simply was out of their thinking. That had been lost. That great liberal conception, coming in with the English Puritan Revolution of the to get rid of the court of Star Chamber and establish the principle of an independent judiciary, that principle had been lost to sight among a people who, more than any other in this world, like to call themselves democratic in the political sense of the word. Well, when you lose to sight those principles, which alone give substance and vitality and reality to political democracy, then you're in a rather serious way. That's not the only case. A little later, you remember, came up Mr. Roosevelt's famous speech for the Four Freedoms. As you know, the United States Constitution says that the Congress shall pass no law affecting an establishment of religion. In other words, in the United States, there can be no such thing as a heretic. Just as politically, there can be no such thing as a commoner. That is good from the social viewpoint. That is fine for a democratic principle. You cannot be a heretic in the United States because there is no established church. And by the Constitution, it was laid down that the government should never interfere from that. But man's faith in God was a natural right which came from God. And the state had nothing to do with it. It's the only applicability, so far as the state was negative, the state should never lay hands on that principle in any way. No law should be passed. No law could be passed by Congress on that subject. Well, what does Mr. Roosevelt do? And frankly, nobody knows this when he says it. He says in the Four Freedoms, the foremost of them was freedom of religion, which should be assured by the boy left, they took up the question of foreign aid. Mr. Russell Kirk commented something where the administration was defeated and in a totalitarian mood. Here's one which is still uncertain. As you know, as you doubtless know, I don't want to labor the details, but the provision in the bill for foreign aid was that the administration should be given 5 years of power to distribute this aid, taking it directly from the Treasury without the Congress having anything to say in the matter. That was the real philosophic political principle at stake in this legislation, not the amount, but whether the constitutional limitation on whether the power of the purse should be taken from the Congress and given to the executive for a five-year period. And, of course, it's here before, it's always been under each Congress to decide those things. But in order to secure more efficiency, as was argued, we said the executive should have this power for 5 years. The principle of state there was obviously, again, the power of the purse, one of the fundamental liberal traditions of things. Now, the Senate accepted this thing, and here is a quotation from the leading paper, in the country, the Baltimore Sun, for the next day. This is straight reporting. By a vote of 56-39, the Senate rejected an amendment that would have forced the government to obtain year-by-year appropriations from Congress. Well, it would have been much more correct to say that thing, that the Senate rejected an amendment that would have upheld the constitutional ruling whereby each year the appropriations must be reviewed by the Congress. But just by that, and I'm sure was unconscious, that change of emphasis, saying that an amendment designed to uphold the Constitution would have forced the government, and we think of the administration now as the government, just as they do in England, you see the complete change of emphasis there. Here is something which is hampering. Here is something which is hampering the extension of the authority of the state. But the undermining of these great concepts, which seems to me, these great political concepts, all of which were of liberal introduction, all of which we associate with liberalism, as being the real problem of today. And to combat that, I myself come more and more to the thinking that we have got to have an alternative authority to the state. That in the days when you spoke of Christendom and the word had some reality, that you had an alternative authority to the state. But that our great weakness at the present time is that in our various national assemblies, we have no particular authority, no authority to whom we will yield our ultimate loyalty as opposed to that of the state itself. And I think it still remains true that render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. But I think the characteristic of our modern age is that fewer and fewer things seem to belong to God and more things belong to the state. Well, In closing, I insisted that the consideration should be confined to democracy and liberalism, that conservatism as a word is left out completely. I assume on the assumption that the true liberal is a conservative and the real conservative is a liberal. I'm not so sure. I think there are three classifications in human thinking. But all these things, all these political terms, one must remember, they're relative. Coming over here, we passed close to the Azores, and they pointed out to me a mountain which they said was one of the highest in the world. And I said, well, it's a fine mountain, but it doesn't look very high. And they said, oh, that mountain is 7,000 feet above the water, but it goes 20,000 feet straight down, so it's practically as high as Everest if you look at it properly. Well, I can see that from the viewpoint of an octopus, that would be a 27,000-foot mountain. But from the viewpoint of myself, it was only a 7,000-foot mountain. I refer to that for this reason, that when we are in a period of, you might say, progress, an extended grasp, and the liberal is pushing on with new creative ideas, and on that upward phase, the conservative can be called a drag on the liberal, holding it back. But when you are in a period, which I think we must admit today, politically at least, of retrogression, then the conservative is in a stronger position. The liberal must move back, because he doesn't want to pull things down. He must move back. And the liberal and the conservative, therefore, in a period of this sort, are combined, work together. McCulloch necessarily move towards collectivization, and it is the fact that there is doubt on these subjects, as well as the fact that they are so important and really so little considered in our thinking at the present time. It is the fact that there is doubt